Chapter 26. More Rum Running. Strange to say, my first experience in abetting a liquor smuggling party was nearly my last. The chief considered it would be as well for me to learn, or at least observe, the methods of landing booze while the shipwrights were finishing up their work on the vessel. Naturally, I was glad of the opportunity both to observe and, what was of equal importance, earn the $50 paid for ferrying cases of liquor between ship and shore. At Rockaway Beach, an hour before midnight, I arrived at the dockyard where my boat, the Voltaire, was being outfitted. Gathered in the workshop were the members of my crew and half a dozen local boatmen. It was pitch dark and a bitter cold night. We spoke in whispers, and the atmosphere was charged with the excitement attendant on this first night of the rum season opening on Long Island. A lookout was posted at the door commanding the laneway abutting on the road along which must soon come the big trucks from New York. These would transport boats and men down to the beach, some 5 miles distant from the shipyard. We were also awaiting Walter Waddle, or Bimbo, as he was more familiarly known. Walter was boss of the shipyard and all booze operations in this section of Long Island. He was an extraordinary character, too, and had been in the rum racket since the Volstead Act was put in force. He had sampled every phase of the business as well, unfortunately, as every variety of the commodity it concerned. I have never met a more efficient all-round executive. He could build a ship from truck to keelson, install the engines, sail as engineer or skipper, and, believe it or not, he carried all the plans of his various operations in his head. He knew a blueprint backways, but never used one. In the legal channels of industry, Walter Waddle would have soared to great heights, but the lure of the rum racket bound him hand and foot. He was generous, he was tough, but above all, he had the power of organization. Handling a couple of hundred American gangsters on land and sea and making them work calls for genius. Bimbo had lots. Tom Swanson, my chief mate, entered the workshop from without, where he had been on sentry go. He signaled me out in the dark. "A car's coming, Cap. I think it's Bimbo." Sure enough, along came Waddle. Out he jumped, exuding energy and confidence. "All the gang here?" he asked quietly. "Dories, oars, and the thole pins okay?" This was fired at Tom, one of the best boatmen on Long Island. He could get a dory through a surf that would swamp a destroyer. Tom murmured, "All okay, boss," in his pleasant Swedish drawl. Bimbo then explained the plan of campaign. When the two trucks came along, two dories and 6 men would ride in each. I should accompany him in the two-seater and lead the way, the trucks following. Bimbo and I were armed with automatics, but there would be no shooting at this stage. Coming back, maybe. The trucks arrived, headlights dimmed, and were quickly loaded. Then the crowd swarmed aboard, and with little fuss, we drove along the deserted highway towards Auvergne. It was now 30 minutes past midnight, and respectable members of the community were snugly abed, little dreaming of the invasion of their select village by the cream of New York's underworld. It was the first big unloading of the winter season. Would it augur a run of wealth? Anyway, we were all anxious to start making some real money. Soon the salty tang of the sea assailed my nostrils. I could hear the booming of the surf increasing in the volume of its sound. The dread of federal surveillance and a lightning raid was always present, but we reached the drop in safety. Jumping out, I saw the beach black with moving figures, sharply etched on the background of smooth white sand. It was freezing, and the hard sand and ice crystals, reflecting the rays of a crescent moon, caused ripples of light and shade to flow over the surface like undulations on a silken robe. Overhead, the clouds raced across the sky in thin, wispy streaks of cirrus, or bulging cumulus formations intermittently blotting out the pale, cold light of the waning moon. Away off in the distance, where the ink-black sea cut the horizon, the three occulting flashes of the Ambrose lightship were visible, silently and commandingly domineering the channel leading to the harbour of New York. But the most striking feature in this nocturne nauticus was the slim, pearl-grey yacht riding to anchor out beyond the booming surf. She lay like a ghost, not a light or sign of life visible. When an extra dark cloud obscured the moon, she vanished completely like a wraith. As the cloud melted away, she took on gaseous shape until, gradually, a clear sky revealed the graceful hull in delicate outline. The voice of Swanson at my elbow dragged me down to earth. "Going to be tough getting through the surf, Cap. I don't think we'll make it. The wind's going round to the southward of east." "I thought that the moment we struck the beach, Tom," I replied. "Guess we'll take a shot at it anyway." The dories were unloaded off the trucks and carried bodily down to the water's edge. The surf looked formidable. Every now and then a huge roller would race shorewards, rear up in a white hissing ridge, and then collapse with a detonation that seemed to shake the beach. Our only hope would be to get the boats out through the combers before one of these monsters had grown to maturity. We lined the boats up, about 100 feet apart. Danny Krebs, an engineer on the Voltaire, took the first dory, Swanson the second, myself the third, and Pete, one of the sailors, and a skilled boatman, the fourth. Waiting a favourable chance, I sang out, "Let's go, boys!" With the aid of three men, we ran the boat out into the water until we were submerged to the waist. We allowed a couple of big rollers to get by, holding desperately. Then I jumped into the dory, which became a living thing once in its natural element, and grabbed the oars. The three gangsters gave the boat a short run and a shove seaward to get me started. I buried the oars in the boiling water and strove to get clear of the surf. I was making good headway too, endeavouring to keep the bow of the boat head on to the breakers. Two more hills and I'd be clear of the surf. Suddenly, it seemed that the whole ocean came rushing for me. The dory was thrown bodily up into the air on the apex of a roaring, hissing geyser, and I flew over the stern into the boiling confusion of water. I was buffeted, blinded, and all but suffocated in the seething whirl. Like a thunderbolt from the sky, I sensed, rather than saw, a massive body descend on me. I threw up my hands, preferring to drown rather than be split in two by the falling dory. I remembered nothing more until I came to on the beach, dazed and shivering with the cold. Danny Krebs commandeered a car and drove me to his home, where a hot bath and a change of clothes soon put me fit as a fiddle. Swanson was the only man who got his boat through. With another hand in the dory, he managed to make the yacht just as the craft swamped and was washed away from underneath them. They were pulled on board the yacht, just making her in time to escape drowning after swimming in ice-cold water. The unloading attempt was called off, and the yacht ordered back to the schooner cruising offshore. Some of the boys who witnessed my immersion stated that the boat was catapulted into the air like a chip of wood. How I escaped being poleaxed when it struck the water can only be explained by the guardian angel whose protective influence has been my salvation 100 times or more. After failure to unload at the beach, we decided to do this job with a newly outfitted speedboat capable of carrying 400 cases. It would mean, of course, running the gauntlet, both going out of Rockaway Inlet and returning. Rockaway Inlet, the entrance to Jamaica Bay, was well patrolled by Coast Guard cutters, besides being overlooked by the Coast Guard station at the point. But the bay is a veritable maze of creeks and channels, and once in these, no Coast Guard could ever hope to catch us. We had a special pilot for this tricky part, Dominic, a clever Italian seaman whose skill had bested the Coast Guards through 10 years of liquor smuggling. 2 nights after the beach failure, a radio message was sent to the Canadian yacht Semiramis, instructing her to be at a point 3 miles due south of the hospital, Rockaway Beach, at midnight. The hospital was a conspicuous building directly facing the ocean front and easily picked up from seaward. With Danny and Pete, we took the links down the inlet. Hugging the shore opposite the Coast Guard station, we spotted a 36-footer cruising to seaward of the inlet. Waiting until he was at the western extreme of the patrol, I gave the full ahead on our three Liberty motors. Like a flash, the Lynx shot through the narrow sluice, scarce 100 feet across, and in a trice was outside in the open sea, unnoticed in the darkness of the November night. The Semiramis was cruising slowly off the appointed rendezvous. I went alongside, and immediately we took our load of booze on board. Tom Swanson and his mate were glad to get off the Canadian, where the food was not up to American standards and the accommodation limited, all space being utilized for storage purposes. We soon loaded to capacity and were back underway again, heading for the inlet. Could I dodge the Coast Guard cutter again? It was now much darker and commencing to blow with light snow squalls for good measure. Visibility was poor, so we had reason to be elated. As I had to make 2 trips to unload the yacht, I was anxious to get the first lot in without a chase. We crept along at a nice speed of about 14 knots, the Lynx could do 35 easily, gained the sluice, and were soon racing up the inlet to the railway drawbridge. Once through the bridge, nothing in the United States Navy could catch us in the maze of creeks. Everything worked to perfection, so much so that I grew worried. The mob and trucks were waiting at a coal dock, and soon the first load of the season was discharged from the Lynx and rumbling citywards to the booze warehouses in New York. The moment the last case hit the dock, the ropes were let go and the Lynx was outward bound again. By this time it was snowing steadily, and the night in its darkest hours between 3 and 4 a.m. I felt confident of dodging the Coast Guard cutters. We knew that their vigilance relaxed in bad weather. As a rule, they ran for shelter in preference to being rolled about in their glorified motorboats. We negotiated the sluice without incident. I was heading on a course that would bring me about 0.5 mile seaward of the yacht, thus guarding against the possibility of running him down in such thick weather. Tom Swanson, who was now with me, kept a sharp lookout. I was steering, using the outside wheel abaft the small pilot house, for it was impossible to steer below with such poor visibility and only a small porthole through which to peer. Any moment now I expected to be within range of the Semiramis, and was about to alter course when Tom yelled excitedly, "What's that, Cap?" and pointed to a blur away off our port bow. I looked and saw a Coast Guard cutter heading straight for us. I ran full speed on all motors, threw the helm over, and dashed south-southeast out to open sea. We had the advantage in speed, but not sufficient to get us out of range before he got his gun into action. Tom was now lying down in the cabin and occasionally looking out through the half-door of the companionway. I peered over my shoulder. They were shooting. I could see the spurts of flame spitting through the murk. I zigzagged, knowing full well the effect of changing the gun sighting on such a choppy sea. I was just congratulating myself on the success of my maneuver when I heard a quick drumming sound on the side of the wheelhouse. I altered my course slightly. Going close on 40 miles an hour, a flick of the wheel was enough. Then something struck me. My first sensation was one of pleasant warmth. Then suddenly I realized that I was wide awake and in the water. The Lynx was disappearing in thick sleet and snow. The Coast Guard cutter roared past not 20 feet away without seeing me. I had joined the rum racket for excitement. I was getting it. Clad in oilskins and sea boots, with heavy woolen clothes underneath, swimming was out of the question. Moreover, I could see with only one eye. With much maneuvering, I managed to shake off one boot. This helped a little, but made me side heavy. Of rescue, I had no hope, but at regular intervals, I shouted, "Help!" There was quite a sea running, but not enough to worry a good swimmer. As I rose on the crest of a wave, I could see the shore lights of Far Rockaway sometimes breaking through the mist of snow and rain. Was this to be my end? To drown like a rat in the ignominious profession of rum running? I was working under an assumed name, and it flashed to me that my passing would go unnoticed. I thought of all my previous escapes, but was convinced that in all of them there had been a sporting chance. I had to shout less frequently now to conserve my breath. I felt myself growing weaker. It was more difficult to keep my head clear of the water. My mind was extremely active at the beginning of the ordeal, but I was gradually becoming resigned and lethargic. Then, just as my arms refused to paddle longer, I heard a sound that electrified me. It was the rattle of davit blocks, someone far off lowering a boat. The Lynx had no boat davits. She carried the dories lashed on the after deck. It must be the Coast Guard. I waited for the splash of oars, but nothing happened. Then, horror of horrors, I heard the rattle of the blocks again. They were hoisting the boat back on board. I knew the full meaning of the word despair, but the good guardian angel must have been standing by. I heard the splash of oars and a faint hail in the distance. I answered help as loudly as I could and kept repeating it at regular intervals. A couple of minutes later, the high bow of a Canadian dory pushed out of the gloom and headed straight towards me. I was saved. I was too heavy with seawater to clamber into the boat, so I hooked my arm over the gunwale and in this fashion was towed back to the Semiramis. On the way back, Blackie, the supercargo and representative of the rum barons, told me what had transpired. When I was shot overboard, a burst of machine gun bullets cut through the upper corner of the wheelhouse, ripping away the angle iron binding the corner. This must have struck me on the forehead, for my left eyebrow was nearly severed and hung down over the eye, blotting out my sight. I had two more deep cuts on my forehead, all bleeding profusely. Swanson eluded the Coast Guard, cruised inshore, and picked up the yacht. He went alongside and told them of my mishap. Old MacDonald, the skipper, and Blackie ordered a boat over. They attempted to launch a light dinghy, but in the long groundswell, the rolling yacht made this a feat of rare skill. In the rush to get the boat quickly in the water, the after boat falls jammed while the forward tackle went by the run. As a result, the boat hung perpendicularly from the after davit, swinging and crashing widely against the side of the Semiramis until the dinghy was smashed to pieces. After some delay in casting the wrecked boat adrift and clearing tackles, another boat was hooked on, and with more caution, safely put over the side. Blackie took command, and to his perseverance and promptitude, I owe my life. The crew of the yacht hauled me out of the water on board. They were astounded that anyone could have remained afloat so long under such conditions of wind and weather. A seaman tied a rude bandage tightly around my head to keep the eyebrow in position and stop the bleeding. Now that the ordeal was over, my head throbbed violently. I felt half frozen and utterly wretched. The Lynx was now alongside, loading. I went on board. Down in the engine room, I discovered a quiet corner out of the way, where I sat on the warm copper motor exhausts and thawed myself. Soon we were racing home. Luck was with us this time, and we reached the inlet without seeing another craft of any description. A quick run up the channel, and we were alongside the drop discharging our second cargo. When the last case was put on the last truck, 7 o'clock chimed in a nearby church. Dawn was streaking the sky in a pale orange tint, and the familiar sounds of a new day being born sounded vaguely in the cold, bleak morning. The wind had subsided, but the snow fell thick and silently. Houses and trees were covered under the soft white mantle. Even the Lynx looked beautiful amidst these new effects. A jarring note came from the 2 score and 10 gangsters on the dock. Guards were being allocated to each motor truck. One, riding in front with the driver, was armed with a sawed-off shotgun and a Colt 45 automatic. Two thugs rode in the body of the truck with the liquor. They had a Thompson machine gun and an automatic apiece. The danger lay not from the law, but from hijackers, for these desperados asked no quarter nor gave any. As killers, they had a high social standing in the gang and received a steady wage from the rum directorate for their murderous abilities. The rank and file piled into waiting autos, and the whole cavalcade drove off citywards, spreading out fanwise as they left the environs of the dock. To avoid undue suspicion, I waited until 9 a.m. before proceeding to the hospital, where 8 stitches were put in my wounds. My baptism in the rum racket was certainly thorough. Others I knew were not quite so fortunate. They did not escape. The Voltaire was now nearing completion. Already the 2 diesel motors were installed and accommodation quarters for officers and crew finished. We only awaited the shipping of our fuel tanks to be ready for the smuggling of contraband on a large scale. While we were waiting for the final touches, I ran in 3 more loads on the Lynx from the Canadian, getting through safely each time. At last, the Voltaire was ready for sea. She was 125 feet long, with a cruising speed of 14 knots. When opened out full, she could attain a speed of 18.5 knots, giving me a slight bulge on most of the cutters of the Coast Guard. One bitterly cold morning in December, we cast off our moorings at the shipyard and moved slowly out into the creek. I blew the whistle to have the railroad bridge opened, and as the moving section swung around, I gave the Voltaire the gun and dashed through the opening to test our speed on the measured mile stretch beyond. The boat just flashed over the surface. Timing her to the second, I calculated her speed to be close on 20 land miles per hour. We were all elated. Once we had a good start, this speed would make it difficult for anything to overhaul us. On the way out to the inlet, a 75-footer lay in wait. He signaled for me to stop. A boarding party came on board, but all our papers were in order. I was sailing under the nom de guerre of Olsen. It would be embarrassing if I was captured under my own name after being recommended for the highest honor the United States government allows a distinguished citizen. The Coast Guards knew full well the nature of our mission, but there was no evidence they could pull us in for. The petty officer in command, who was a Scandinavian, doubted the authenticity of my accent, which has a decided Celtic flavor. "You speak damn funny for a Swede," he said. "So would you," I replied, "if you were married to a woman called McGinnis." "Go to hell," he snapped. "I'll catch you yet." Our rendezvous was with a Canadian schooner hailing from Lunenburg, Nova Scotia. She was lying to an anchor 75 miles southeast of the Ambrose lightship. I made a quick run out and was fast alongside the Sister Amanda 6 hours after leaving the dock. I took on board a full load of liquor, 5,000 bales, Scotch and rye whiskey, wines, champagne and brandy, besides kegs of malt on deck. We wirelessed ashore for instructions, and a reply came to proceed to a drop off Long Beach and be there at 2 in the morning. I left the schooner at 5 in the evening, heading for the lightship. As this was our first big load, we were on the qui vive for signs of the enemy. About 7 o'clock, we saw a Coast Guard cutter's light away off the port bow. I hauled up more towards the land, and soon we lost his lights. We thought the cutter had disappeared to the southward, and were happy to get off so easily. "Looks like we'll make it all right, Pete," I said to the man at the wheel, but I had hardly spoken when Swanson, on the lookout, came running to the wheelhouse door. "Full speed, Cap, there's a dollar and a quarter," which means a 125-footer in the rum racket, "firing at us." I looked through the porthole in the after part of the wheelhouse and saw the flashes of the cutter's 1-pounder at intervals of about 40 seconds. I ordered Pete out of the wheelhouse and took over the steering myself. I knew I could outdistance him easily, but dreaded a hit from his gun. We could not see the cutter even with our powerful night glasses, and as his shots were now being fired at long intervals, we calculated we were also invisible. I altered and headed straight for the City Hall in Long Beach, which had a blue light burning in the top tower windows, a steady beacon for the Long Island rum runners. The cutter had ceased fire with the one-pounder. He gave a rapid burst with his machine gun, sweeping an arc of the horizon with lead, then abruptly ceased fire for good. We came up to the drop and flashed a solitary white dash with an electric torch. Keen eyes were watching, for immediately came the answering red flicker. I stopped the engines, ordered the anchor, let go boats over the side, and we were all ready for unloading. Half a dozen dories, loaded with mobsters, came off to get the liquor out of the holds and into the fleet of dories. At 5 a.m., every case was ashore, and we were speeding back to the schooner for another load. The night's work netted me $2,500. I received 50 cents for every case landed. More, that is, for landing one load of booze than was paid to most members of the bird exhibition for 2 years' service under the banner of science. Long Beach, where I was unloading, is a select seaside resort 18 miles from New York City and thronged in the summer months with the elite of New York, among whom were reckoned the lords of New York's underworld. The mayor and chief of police were known to be working in collusion with rum runners, and under their benevolent rule, vice flourished triumphant. After unloading at Long Beach, I raced back to the schooner and loaded up again, with orders to bring 4,000 cases to Rockaway Beach. The Semiramis had returned from Canada, and we arranged to work together in unloading the vessels coming down from St. Pierre. Taking different routes, we managed to get to the drop at the beach at the appointed time and immediately commenced to unload. The Voltaire was anchored about 100 yards astern of the Semiramis, and from both ships, dories loaded with from 50 to 60 cases were ferrying the liquor ashore. Work went smoothly and quickly. I took my usual post on top of the pilot house, and suddenly, looking seaward, I got a shock that nearly made me jump overboard. Sneaking out of the mist like a grey wolf was a 75-foot Coast Guard cutter. In a moment he would be right on top of us. I leapt off the top of the pilot house down to the engine room hatch and yelled at the top of my voice, "All hands ashore!" meaning the shore hands. Tom Swanson and the other members of the crew ran to their stations. Jumping into the wheelhouse, I rang full ahead on the telegraph, but never hoped to be under way in time. Tom had cut the anchor cable, and with Pete and Larry was crouching under the lee of the pilot house, peering round the corner at the oncoming enemy. Suddenly, I felt a vibrating bump on the after end of the boat. "They're about to board us," I thought. Just then, the two diesel engines went into action, and we shot ahead at full speed. This was the signal for the cutter to open fire. I could hear the patter of machine gun bullets spraying the after part of the wheelhouse, but this did not worry me much as it was protected by a barricade of cases. The Canadian lay ahead, and from the shelter of his hull, dories were now being rapidly paddled to the beach. One of these was nearly across my course. It was loaded down to the guards with cases and men. Ringing full astern on the port engine and throwing the wheel over to port, I cleared the dory by the fraction of a foot. Straightening out the vessel on her course, I shot between the Semiramis and the beach, putting him in the line of fire. Although old Mac was going full speed, I passed him as though he were lying at anchor. Realizing that I was too fast for him, the Coast Guard drew alongside the yacht and made an easy capture. 125-footer was patrolling off the Ambrose Light, running without lights. We were past him with half a mile start before he had time to get into action. Snow now began to fall heavily, and with this factor and our superior speed, I was out of range and sight before day broke on the eastern horizon. A couple of days later, I located my schooner and transferred the cases still remaining on board. We had some hard running in store, and our fuel oil was running low. I decided to return to the shipyard for an overhaul. The crew got busy cleaning out their holds, removing all traces of our recent cargo. Petrol and carbolic acid was called into play, and the mingled fumes of these, combined with the assorted bouquet of rye, Scotch brandy, and London gin, severely embarrassed us. The bullet holes in the hull and around the pilot house were stuffed with putty, and the entire surface was covered with a new coat of paint, then sprayed with fine ashes to give an appearance of age. In this way, and thus camouflaged, we got through to home safely, much to our relief. My spell of rest did not last long, however. 2 mornings later, the big boss in New York telephoned to the yard to send out a speedboat to bring in the cases I had returned on board the schooner. Bimbo asked me to take out a boat which was considered the greatest freak in ship construction ever perpetrated on the Atlantic seaboard. This ungainly tub could attain a speed of 35 miles an hour with 3 powerful converted aeroplane motors, but these motors were placed so far forward that, when running, the Maureen, as she was named, ran with her head well down and her stern sticking up like a bull charging in the ring. As a result of this peculiar construction, the exhausts were clear of the water when running, but submerged when stopped, thus allowing the water back up through the pipes into the motors. At sea, the motors had to be kept going all the time to save the vessel from swamping. In port, lying alongside the dock, it was easy to plug these exhausts. I was by no means enthusiastic to go to sea in such a craft. It was midwinter, freezing hard, with occasional blizzards devastating the coast, so it was with misgivings that Pete, and a crack motor mechanic whom I knew as Harold, and myself set off to intercept the schooner at a point 10 miles south of Fire Island Lightship. It was snowing and blowing hard by the time I picked up the schooner, and a heavy sea running made it a difficult job to get alongside and load the 400 cases of liquor. When we were loaded, the captain of the schooner wirelessed ashore for instructions where and when he should unload. The reply from New York came, "Stand by the schooner until midnight for further orders." Easier said than done. A heavy sea was running, and every spray that came on board froze solid on the hull of the Maureen. We made fast astern of the schooner on a long rope and waited for midnight. Midnight came and a message. "Don't come to the Rockaways or Long Beach. Try somewhere to the eastward. When you make a landing, phone headquarters." "We'll shove this stuff back on the schooner or else dump it overboard. It's either that or drown," I grumbled. "Those guys sitting in a warm nightclub on Broadway don't care a hoot what becomes of us. The liquor is the principal consideration." I cast off the rope to which we were fast and headed close up under the schooner's lee. It was now too rough to go alongside, so I shouted across to the captain to put his dories in the water and boat the cases back. I was sinking and using all the petrol to keep the motors going to expel the water from the exhausts. The Canadian refused point blank, stating that no boat could live in such a sea. But I threatened there and then to dump every case over the side and have him charged with the loss. He could see we were just keeping afloat, so with much cursing and growling, he ordered his men to the dories. It was a horrible job handling those small boats on a mountainous sea. It took 4 hours to ferry the 400 cases across to the schooner, and at that time the Maureen was a solid block of ice carrying just as heavy a load when the cases were discharged as when we first loaded from the schooner. I lost no time in getting underway. Pete and I took 15-minute spells at the wheel, which was outside and exposed to the vicious cut of wind and sea. I headed up for Fire Island, hoping to make the inlet and get into shelter of the channel leading to the yacht basin in Bayshore. We were doubtful if the unwieldy craft would remain afloat long enough. We'd long since picked up the flash of the lighthouse, but we knew it was hopeless to try the entrance. Our only chance was to run full speed for the beach and hope to get far enough into the sand to jump ashore. "Do your best, Harold," I shouted in the howling wind. 10 minutes will see us ashore or in hell." At last, we were in the surf and racing shorewards like an express. The nightmare of the breakers was past. We jumped down onto the beach that was covered by only a few inches of yeasty water and ran shores, happy to have escaped. Not a moment too soon. The Maureen split in two. She would never violate any law again. I formed a similar resolution, but the urge to be doing something chained me to the racket for several months to come. 4 weeks later, during which time we had the Voltaire made 100% seaworthy, saw us heading north for Saint-Pierre-Miquelon, a French possession to the southward of Newfoundland, to load a full cargo of contraband liquor for New York. The long trip north was uneventful, but I knew the U.S. Coast Guards would be on the lookout for our return and every care would be needed. I was determined, however, to get through on a point of honour. Just before dark, when we were in home waters at a point about 15 miles east of Nantucket Shoals lightship, Pete, who was on the lookout, spotted a big white cutter away to starboard. I wondered if they could see us, as we presented very little above the waterline that would be visible at such a distance. Besides, the drab grey paint of the hull and deckhouses was a blend of my own special mixing designed to make detection under such lighting very difficult. I trained my binoculars on the craft to see how he was heading and figured that they were making a westerly course for Montauk Point or close thereabouts. The cutter had probably lain under cover of the lightship, a favourite ruse when on the lookout for rum runners bound for the Connecticut and Long Island drops. Soon it would be dark, and then I could carry on without fear of detection. I altered course a little to swing more out of his way. All hands were now on deck and eagerly watching the movements of the enemy. I looked through the door of the wheelhouse and could see the masthead lights and side lights of the stranger heading straight towards us. As usual, I swung around and ran full speed to the eastward in the general direction of Spain. Every now and then I took a look through the small porthole in the after bulkhead. I could see the vicious flash when he fired. Had they got our range? As if to answer me, a projectile hit the surface of the sea not 100 feet away. I shouted to Tom, standing on the foredeck, "Reverse and switch on the side lights and the masthead light." Seeing the masthead light and side lights approaching, the Coast Guard considered we had turned back on our course and were surrendering. They immediately ceased fire and slowed down to await our arrival. The truth was, we were speeding away at full blast with the added advantage of knowing that the enemy had slowed down. Had the Coast Guard cutter's captain been vindictive, he could have blown us out of the water the moment we exposed ourselves clearly with our running lights. That was the chance I took. So, honours were even. Daybreak found us well at sea, with not a ship visible all round the horizon. At 9 a.m., I took a sight for longitude to determine our position. We were 115 miles east-southeast of Fire Island Light. I laid a course for the Ambrose lightship, the old point of entry and departure now so familiar. At noon, I took a meridian sight for latitude and made an alarming discovery. I was too far northward. I checked my figures but found no error, so slightly altered course to make up for the mysterious drift since the morning sights. A lookout was stationed to pick up the flash of Fire Island, which we should pass in the afternoon at the appointed time. Nothing was to be seen. Soundings were taken, but did not correspond to the place where we should be on the chart. I was worried. Then I found I had made an error in the carryover figure in adding the zenith distance to the declination to get the latitude. Working now from the correct position at noon, I found I had the Voltaire down off Atlantic City on the New Jersey coast, a startling discovery as the stretch of coast was rigidly patrolled. As I altered course to the northward, a 125-footer appeared over the horizon and immediately gave chase. We showed him our heels and made away full speed, heading straight for Fire Island. If we couldn't slip him, we were cornered. In Saint-Pierre, I had bought 100 fathoms of old fishing nets. As the cutter was following right in our wake, Pete, Tom, and Larry paid out the nets cautiously over the stern so as not to foul our propellers. If the cutter ran full speed into this mass, The netting would stream along both sides and be dragged into and around his screws. This would not only foul the propellers, but would possibly wreck his diesel motors. To make doubly sure, I ordered the boys to toss 4 kegs of malt whiskey overboard. A boat hitting one of these 10-gallon kegs at top speed would probably stave in her bow and throw a somersault. Through the thickening dusk, we could see a machine gun spitting out its message of death. It was as I predicted. The cutter went up into the air and the chase was ended. Afterwards, I heard that the survivors told a tale of being blown up in the forward compartment, losing 2 propellers and sustaining smashed engines. 6 weeks later, the Voltaire was lying offshore waiting for orders. We had no radio on board this trip, but had been informed by mail in Saint-Pierre that a plane would bring off a message with instructions where to land the load we had brought from Miquelon. About noon, we spotted an aeroplane coming out of the west and knew it was for us by the landing wheels. 3 or 4 times it circled, getting lower each time. Then it pitched a bottle over the side. We had a dory standing by, which retrieved the message. I read, "Be at Avern 2 a.m. Good luck." I chalked a big OK on the pilot house roof, and the plane swooped down in salute, then darted off and disappeared into the west. We cruised leisurely up to the beach, aiming to get there in time and allowing for pursuit. 2 o'clock to the minute, I dropped anchor off Avern in the Rockaways. The usual signal was flashed, but the standby signal was returned. I was surprised. I could see no preparation on the beach, no gang, nothing. Then a dory came splashing alongside. One of the crew handed me a message. "Come up the inlet to the old drop. Avern too hot. Bimbo." We hove up anchor with premonitions of evil and headed for the dangerous inlet. It seemed like tempting providence to use this channel where a 36-footer continuously prowled. All this, too, on a night as clear as midday with a full moon riding high in a cloudless sky. In the sharp cold air, sounds carried for miles, and the ponderous hum of our powerful motors had not a zephyr of wind to hide them. In nervous caution, we ran half speed up the inlet. The engineer had orders from me, in case of pursuit, to get lots of calcium carbide into the exhaust to throw up a good smoke screen. If there should be any shooting inside the inlet, we were done for. Luck got us through the bridge and alongside the dock, without interference. Work went on feverishly. The stacks of liquor on the dock looked like small mountains. In an hour, we'd all be in our beds and another good deed safely accomplished. But this was not to be. I was standing in the wheelhouse, taking shelter from the cold morning air and half asleep after 24 hours on duty, when out of the blue came the surprising and startling order, "Come on, throw 'em up, everybody!" I looked up at the dock and saw the uniforms. The load was grabbed all right. Well, they wouldn't grab me if I could help it. The motors were turning over dead slow, as they always did at an unloading. Dominic was sitting on a case of champagne when the first commotion arose. He jumped to his feet and grabbed the wheel. We looked at each other and smiled. I grabbed both handles of the engine room telegraphs and rang, "Full speed ahead!" There was a roar of command from the dock, but too late. We snapped the ropes as if they were a spider's web and shot out into midstream. The liquorators opened fire with their revolvers, but we laughed at these weapons. The Voltaire had survived tougher barrages than that. Out in the creek, a launch was cruising. They whistled for us to stop, but we dashed madly past and round a little island. It was low water at the time, and we took the turn too sharp. The Voltaire came to a shuddering stop with the launch close behind. The jig was up. Deserting the unhappy rumbo to her fate, we all leapt over the side and swam the few yards to the shore. Luckily, we grounded on a bank on the mainland opposite the little island and in a district where Dominic was well known. Soaking wet and shivering, we ran through the marsh grass to a small shack where the occupants were wide awake. We were made heartily welcome, and while waiting for the automobile to warm up, we all took generous draughts of rye. Pete, Dominic, and everyone, with the exception of myself, had managed to salvage a couple of bottles apiece. The cargo was confiscated in its entirety, as was the boat. All my savings were in this last load. I took this as retribution for trying to get rich quick, but no one can say it was the easiest means. The rum barons offered me a larger and better boat to continue, but I turned down their offers. I had sampled the rum racket. I had enjoyed the excitement. I had liked the fellows on the boats. Big Bill, the boss in New York, was a gentleman. But there was something about the whole thing that disgusted me. Risking your life for an ideal is satisfying, but risking your life to make money, especially for others, had no point. The problem the proletariat in Soviet Russia had set out to solve made a strong appeal to the rebel in me. I went to Russia. This concludes the main text, but there follows an appendix where the author talks about sea shanties.